fear that we might have something of a perfect storm with slumping crude prices and the Fed giving all kinds of signals one week, changing them the next.
This market has been grappling for leadership for a long time. The market needs a catalyst, and it's not going to be bad news being good news.
We probably won't get one, which means we're going to continue to be in this fog of wondering if they'll do it here probably in December.
A lot of what we've been seeing in the economy, the markets could be built on a precipice of paper here, and that is the Federal Reserve and how much we are dependent on it.
I think that one of the reasons the market reacted the way it did is not because they're necessarily afraid of 25 basis points, but they're afraid of a Federal Reserve that is so incompetent that they would talk like this when all the recent data actually points more to recession and disinflation than inflation in a booming economy.
With strong leadership, particularly from Congress, you know, we always look to the White House for leadership, but sometimes it's overlooked that if Congress can provide that safety, then I think the markets will react, they'll have confidence going forward, and we'll continue to flourish.
That would be breaking news. Congress grows a backbone.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, markets are just struggling barely to hold on to some positive gains this week. We've got the Dow up about 0.25%. Some of the markets are weak, but we also have a nice rally in utilities this week after being hit. And of course, nothing really major moving the markets this week other than, you know, once again, what will they do? The Fed is going to be meeting here towards the end of the month. I don't think anything's going to come of it, but we're also going to get ready for third quarter earnings. So anybody that has bad laundry, well, they're going to want to get that out in the next 2 weeks. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Coming up in hour one today, Dan Wojtrowski will be joining us. He says he's a bit cautious here on September and October. We normally get those stormy periods in the market traditionally, but he says any correction that we get here, save some money and keep it on the sidelines and start making out your shopping list. He thinks stocks are heading higher. Also, Greg Weldon will be joining me later on in the program as we take a look at energy. He expects energy is about to break out as we get towards the end of the year, November, December. I hate to say it, folks, as consumers, you may be looking at higher gasoline prices.
And I'm John Loeffler. Today, we're doing a special big picture. We'll have an hour-long interview with Lionel Shriver. And what we're discussing here is her new novel about the future, which takes place in 2029, which is forecasting the collapse of the U.S. dollar and the negation of all debts and everything that might be concomitant or concurrent with that. My question has always been, what does it mean when you say a collapse of the dollar? What are the implications of that? We'll see what it is she has to say today on The Big Picture. And first, as always, we go and take a look at the markets. And Chris Sheridan, who is host of our weekday FS Insider program, is sitting in today for Ryan Poplava. So I'll ask you with an innocuous question. What happened in the markets this week?
Well, John, if we look at the numbers, the S&P 500 ended up the week at 11 points or 0.5%. The Dow was up 36 points or 0.2%. The Russell 2000 was up just slightly under 0.5%. But the big standout was the NASDAQ, which retraced most of its losses after last Friday's sell-off. And it ended the week up 118 points or 2.3%. And a large part of that was based on the very strong move that we saw in Apple, which was actually up 11.4% for the whole week. So Apple saw a very large gain this week based on their iPhone 7 sales. Part of that is probably related to the Samsung recall that we're seeing as well. So those two things together have helped Apple out quite a bit. That sent the NASDAQ higher above most of the other indices.
Well, we've discussed a lot about the activity in the oil markets. I know Greg Weldon's going to do that again later here on the program, but we did have a small decline in oil this week. So the factors behind that.
Yeah, John, oil prices did take a stumble. WTI declined about 6% this week to $43 a barrel, and I think it even got as low as $42 a barrel at one point. And a large part of that was based on an International Energy Agency report. They warned on Tuesday that global oil demand was slowing faster than they had expected, and so they revised their figures, and that they also expected the global supply glut would likely persist well into next year. And for that reason, energy stocks actually did come under pressure this week. But most of the fireworks, I would have to say, were in the financial sector. And Wells Fargo took a pretty big hit this week. It was down 6.75% for the week. And that's based on an agreement to pay a $190 million settlement for creating fake accounts. A Reuters article points out that Wells Fargo has now lost roughly $19 billion off its market value since the probe was disclosed last week that Wells Fargo employees had created roughly 2 million fake accounts for customers without their knowledge in order to meet internal sales targets. And Reuters goes on to say that the bank has now fired 5,300 people over the scandal. So that is pretty big news. And once again, Wells Fargo seeing a fairly large decline this week at 6%. If we actually move over to the other side of the world into Europe, we also saw some fireworks with Deutsche Bank. It saw its worst week in 5 years, and it fell over 9% just on Friday, yesterday, and over 12% for the week in total. And that's based on a report that the Department of Justice is asking Germany's largest lender, that's Deutsche Bank, to pay a hefty $14 billion fine for their involvement in packaging and selling mortgage-backed securities in the lead-up to the financial crisis that we saw back in 2008, 2009. So the Wall Street Journal actually quoted a former Justice Department official to explain why such a large amount. The $14 billion is quite a bit larger than what other banks have had to pay for similar settlements. And what he said was pretty interesting. He says, the point with coming in with a number like that is to set expectations, to express the seriousness of the conduct from the department's perspective, and to signal that in order for negotiations to continue, the financial institution is going to have to put a significant amount of money on the table as a counter. So basically, they put that $14 billion out there, and that's really, like he says, a starting point to set a signal to the wider industry as well, because there are a number of other banks, not just Deutsche Bank, but many others that are also involved with this probe by the Department of Justice. And so really, we're seeing pressure on the financial sector as a whole. What's going on with Wells Fargo adding to that, but European banks also saw a pretty big slide this week. And Deutsche Bank, we should point out, has been a point of focus many times on our show in the past. Many of our guests have pointed out that Deutsche Bank has a very, very large derivatives exposure. They are considered a systemically important financial institution. And so their shares have been falling. If we start to see their shares fall even further, I don't know if they've ever been this low, even if we look at a long-term chart of Deutsche Bank. So if they continue to fall lower and break support, I think there's going to be a lot of attention being paid on Deutsche Bank once again.
All right, Chris, let's transition to the economic front. Would you say there were any significant economic reports which came out this week?
Yeah, the big one was the retail sales figure for August, and that came in weaker than expected. The key takeaway from that report, says Patrick O'Hare at briefing.com, is that discretionary spending activity was weak in August, and it will prompt some downward revisions, most likely to the third quarter GDP forecast. So most economists had expected that number to come in a little bit better. If you've been paying attention to what's going on, you'll know that there's been a lot of focus now on the U.S. consumer being able to hold up the U.S. economy. As we know, business investment has been really dragging. Most of the economists are saying, you know, it's up to the U.S. consumer at this point to move the economy forward. We need to see further wage gains, and that'll provide a tailwind. So a weak report like this that we saw in August is definitely something that is drawing a little bit more concern from economists when we don't see the U.S. consumer pulling their weight, let's say. So that is causing a little bit of a downshift in terms of how much economic growth we're going to see in the second half. And as Patrick Hare notes out, that's probably going to lead to some downward revisions on the part of economists. Now, if you listen to our broadcast with Andrew Zatlin of Moneyball Economics on Thursday, you'll know that he has actually been forecasting retail sales and consumer spending to pull back and weaken into the second half. He's been saying that now since mid-year. And the reason for that is because he has his proprietary Vice Index, which we've discussed with him many times on the show. But basically, that tracks booze, it tracks drugs, it tracks escort services, it tracks gambling as well. I should throw in there a whole wide range of things, which of course we refer to as vices. These are largely very economically sensitive areas of the economy. In many cases, they're cash-based businesses. So they're a really good tell on how much confidence U.S. consumers have in terms of the money in their wallet, whether or not they want to spend it, their confidence about their future. And so he tracks this Vice Index. It leads retail sales by close to a quarter. And if you look at a chart, we did post a chart of his Vice Index and some brief comments that he made from the interview that we conducted with him on Thursday. And I'll just quote what he said. "This is not an environment where a consumer is going to rush out and just splurge. We're at a very harsh inflection point. If companies don't see revenue growth come January, there will be rounds of layoffs, and that's my position, is that we are going to see it in January." So, as he told listeners on Thursday, he thinks we're in the eye of a hurricane. And one of the things he's going to be tracking is his Vice Index going forward, retail sales, of course, holiday spending. He's expecting that to come in weak, and jobless claims. So those are some of the things that you can look at in addition to auto sales. So those are some of the things that we discussed and he said to watch, to monitor, to see if his more dire forecast plays out.
All right, Chris, with that being said, what can we look forward to in the week to come?
Well, the big thing that most people are going to be watching for next week is going to be the meeting that the Fed is going to be conducting, and they're going to perhaps be announcing a rate increase. If we look at the Fed funds futures prices, you can do that by going to the CME Group's FedWatch tool online, and they show that the probability of the Fed raising rates next week is around 15% currently. So the market is not expecting the Fed to hike rates next week. So if the Fed does hike rates, that will certainly be a shock. And, you know, if you want to look at a very interesting view on this, perhaps from a contrarian view, Ben Hunt just wrote a new piece, his Epsilon Theory pieces, which I love to read. And we also posted it on Financial Sense. And he explains that the Fed may even actually go, even though the market is only saying that, you know, there's a 15% probability and that the Fed is not going to be hiking rates. He says the Fed could actually hike rates regardless of what the market thinks, and that is based purely on its reputation. So I would highly recommend you read that piece. It just provides a very insightful view onto this whole ongoing drama with whether the Fed will hike or won't they.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is Lowell Smith. He's Chief Operating Officer and partner of IRA Logix. Lowell, let's talk about some of the things that are available that an individual can do before the end of the year. And I want to talk about two kinds of situations. Let's talk about somebody that's an employee for, let's say, working at a company, and then somebody that is self-employed. But let's begin with the employee first, because a lot of times they don't take advantage of a lot of the tax tools or pension tools that are available to them that give them upfront, or what we call above the line deductions on the front page of their tax return.
Yeah, that's great. A couple of things they might want to consider, and it really depends on their situation, is anybody can make a contribution to an IRA, an individual retirement account. Most individuals think they can only make a contribution if they can deduct that. In some cases, they may be able to deduct that contribution, even if they have a retirement plan at work, particularly if they're at a lower income level. So if you're at certain lower income levels, you have the ability to still make a contribution and deduct it, even if you have a retirement plan. And that depends on each individual, and the tax planner or whoever does that can help them walk through it. Also, TurboTax, if they're doing their own online, actually has tools that will help them ascertain whether they can deduct that or not.
Well, after bouncing all over the place, markets have been coming back, at least on this Thursday. What happens in September? We normally see a downturn in the market. Will that play out for the rest of this month in October? Or will we continue that bullish trend that we saw throughout the summer? Joining me on the program is Dan Wotrubski. Dan, you know, there are a lot of cliches that we use in the market. Sell in May, go away, come back after Labor Day. And then we always talk about the seasonalities that we usually see around this time of the year in September and October being rougher months for the market, being more corrective. Well, sell in May, go away didn't work because we had a nice rally this summer. We are down over the last 30 days if you look at most major markets. But where do you see the markets going here, number one? And number two, what about the seasonalities that we see this time of the year?
Yeah, sure. Well, thanks for having me on again. You know, seasonality has been something we've been working with for several weeks now. Actually, our studies have indicated that the seasonal window for, you know, elevated volatility as far as U.S. equity markets are concerned actually extends probably from the August time frame into mid or late October. And the hit ratio on this, at least going back to our financial crisis of 2008-2009, you know, from what I've seen, has been about 100%. I want to just kind of dial into that 100% hit ratio because it's not 100% that the markets will collapse or trigger a significant structural bear market. We've seen corrections, certainly in this time frame in the magnitude of plus 15%, or I should say minus 15% from the recent highs, to as little as, you know, maybe 1-2%. So it runs the gamut of the type of volatility to expect. But I would say, you know, even barring that and barring any sort of divergence or wide range there, so far it's on track. I mean, look what happened Friday leading more over into this week. We believe that it was a correction in the maximum. We're about 3-4%. We continue to be a little bit cautious over the short run, certainly while the S&P trades under 2150, 2160. So, you know, once again, seasonality has sort of, you know, shown its ugly head to us again. So, you know, our advice to investors, at least for the next few weeks heading into the September-October window, is to remain a bit cautious, expect higher volatility over the short run, but at the same time, get your shopping list together. Because at the end of the day, we think this is ultimately a temporary setback. It's going to give us another buying opportunity, quite frankly, at a better price point for what we believe is an ongoing secular bull market here in the U.S. So, I think the net result of this is to shake some people out. But ultimately, we think the resolution to this is going to be higher. I think it's by year end. And I think that continues on into the new year. From a longer term perspective, quite frankly, we think the markets are going much, much higher. If you take that view as we do, if you would agree with us and our thesis, then, you know, any seasonal weakness that we get over the next several weeks should be looked at as a gift to, again, overweight equities versus, you know, my opinion, the treasury markets, which we believe are at a generational top in treasury prices. As well, to overweight against commodities, which we believe are still in a structural or secular bear market cycle. So we continue to think equities are going to be the outperforming asset class for the next few years. That's despite any seasonal weakness. Any further volatility that we get here, certainly while the S&P trades under 2150, 2160, we're going to use it to slowly scale into equities and then continue to overweight that position.
Dan, you know, I've asked this of a lot of technicians. What is it about this, let's say, late August to October period? Certainly we saw that last year with some big, wild downturns in the month of August and September. What is it about this time of the year? It's almost like, it reminds me of a sailing analogy, the Grand Banks are no picnic in the fall.
Yeah. I mean, it turned into folklore. You know, this sort of seasonal weakness. I mean, you're talking as far back as the markets in October of 1929 or the markets in October of, 1987. You know, these are significant. These are historical periods that traders and investors and, you know, quite frankly, American citizens, but don't forget, this is in our vernacular. And so I think that kind of overlays any short-term analysis that would suggest likewise. And, you know, whether or not it, you know, is a self-fulfilling prophecy, like I said, my data and what I was more concerned with was just over in more recent history, against the backdrop of massive quantitative easing, massive monetary stimulus around the world, obviously geopolitical disruption, obviously, you know, market engineering vis-a-vis buybacks, you know, things that have been supposedly keeping these markets afloat. You know, our question was, in that type of environment, could you still see, you know, this seasonality sort of rear its ugly head? And again, my opinion was that this has been a success, even if the correction is over. I think between Friday and over the last few days, that was kind of the volatility that we were looking for. In other words, that fits the scenario of a seasonally weak period. So it's already been another success for 2016. Again, the next question we want to ask ourselves is, you know, would we consider what's going on here, the beginnings of a major market top or the end of this stock's bull market? And again, as I sort of prefaced in my earlier comments, I mean, I don't believe so at all. We would look at this as another sort of, you know, gift or another buying opportunity. You have to put things into a little bit of perspective here. You know, the markets have actually been through about a 2-year stealth bear market in time, beginning in 2014, and I've actually just broken out of this maybe at the end of June, early July, just after that little Brexit crash that we had. So you had almost 2 years of market consolidation, of repricing underneath the surface, of higher volatility intended to shake out the weaker hand. And so we had the breakout, and the breakout gives us a very strong July and an early part of August, and then the markets become overheated. They're still contending with a massive wall of worry in terms of earnings growth, economic growth, geopolitical landscape, obviously our election landscape and election season coming up. And so I think investor sentiment is utilizing that to take some profits, but we don't think this is going to create, you know, a massive new secular downtrend in equity prices at all. Part of the reason is that typically you look at past cycles, Main Street investors are still largely absent from this stock's bull market. One of the most compelling charts I look at is the progression of the S&P 500 off its bottom in 2008, 2009, at the sort of height of that collapse where the S&P traded as low as 665. We've rallied up to 2,200 on that index. And every year, as the market has grinded higher, we've seen trading volumes move lower and lower. Where we've seen all of Main Street participation has been in fixed income, muni bonds. They're mostly parked on the sidelines relative to the types of trading they did in equities at the height of our last secular bull market. And the one thing we know is secular bull markets typically end with a frenzy from Main Street. We have not seen that yet relative to the other asset classes out there. In my opinion, the equity market is still pretty empty. So I think we have a whole nother leg to go that's going to entice Main Street off the sidelines even further in the years ahead. That's going to be the catalyst that pushes valuations beyond sort of all reasonableness, and which kind of points to any type of secular market top. I don't think we're anywhere near there yet.
So in your opinion, I mean, if we take a look at the economic data over the last 4 or 5 quarters, it's been weak. If we look at corporate earnings, they've been in decline. So do you think it's money flows that are going to be the driver into this market? In other words, let's say towards the end?
I mean, absolutely. And it always is. You know, and that's simply what a technician, you know, looks at. You know, we view, you know, whether it's an asset class or a sector as a stock, everything is competing with each other for your dollar. And money typically goes where it is treated best. That's the highest amount of perceived potential return against the least amount of risk. And this happens now on a global scale, which is easier to attract. So U.S. equities are competing with foreign currencies, competing with other sovereign debt markets. And it's this constant rotation around the world. And this is really what we track. I view U.S. equity markets as a leading indicator of the economy, not a coincident or lagging indicator. And to me, what I believe they are discounting is future economic growth in the years ahead. You and I have talked about this in the past. A lot of it is predicated upon our demographic situation alone relative to other countries where we have this millennial boom generation marching headlong into family formation. U.S. Census data and projections predict that new household formation within the next 10 to 15 years in this country is going to reach new all-time highs. This is money velocity and economic velocity from a new demographic that really has yet to have a big impact on the economy and the system as a whole, because really prior to these last few years, they were kids. So they're growing up, they're getting jobs. And I will tell you this, the economic data of, you know, sort of these key demographic groups is not as bad as any kind of headline number suggests. I'll give you a quick example. National labor participation rate in this country is around 62-63%. Historically low. It's not the worst we've seen, and we have had growth in that type of labor environment in the past. But when you drill down into the more important numbers, we look at labor participation between the key 25 to 54-year-old in terms of the U.S. You keep in mind, this is going to be your biggest producer, your biggest consumer, your biggest investor or saver out of the national rate. Well, that number, labor participation 25 to basically 55, is around 83%. It has turned a major corner. It is diverging from the national rate. And I think that's very bullish for economic velocity and, quite frankly, multiple valuation or multiple expansion, which, again, is a leading indicator of that future economic growth. So, I think there's any number of reasons why the markets are constrained here and why investor sentiment is very bearish. Look, even the markets are schizophrenic in terms of our interest rate environment. On the one hand, they want to see interest rates go higher as a sign of confidence from our Federal Reserve and our central bank. At the same time, look what happened last Friday. We had a major rally and a breakout gap up on the charts of the 10-year note yield. Our bond yields broke out Friday, and the markets collapsed. So, you know, to me, this is an adjustment period from our prior deflationary bear market cycle into our next reflationary bull market cycle. Any adjustment period, we've looked at these in the past in terms of the historical data, they've always been choppy, they've always been sloppy and ugly. And I think the reason is because this generation of investors, the people who are playing the markets, who are investing in the markets, who are working in the markets today, have never seen in their lifetime a reflationary bull market cycle. That is, it's hard for many of us to fathom that you can have economic growth, you can have multiple expansion against the backdrop of a higher rate environment. And I agree, it's tough to make the case right here and now. But again, my thesis relies on the fact that the markets are indeed a leading indicator, not backward looking or not coincident. So I think they're trying to tell us something that's going to be happening down the road. Against that strong labor participation in the key demographic groups, we're also starting to see for the first time in 20, 30 years, you know, some forms of wage reflation. I don't want to call it wage inflation because for 20, 30 years, wages on the national level have actually been deflating, you know, quite significantly. But we're starting to see signs of reflation there. So I have good labor pool statistic data on the group that counts. I'm starting to see signs of wage growth. I'm starting to see signs of tightening job market. We know that the U.S. has taken its foot off the gas of the QE system and is talking about raising rates. We know the ECB and overseas central banks have started alluding to that. That was Friday's breakout in rates right off that announcement. And so this is, you know, a bit of a short-term shock to the system, and I think it's a short-term adjustment process. But I think overall, like I said, this combined with seasonal weakness is going to provide a great, great buying opportunity for investors because I think we're still in a multiple expansion cycle. And again, my thesis is that it's going to be against the backdrop of facing to even higher rates in the years ahead.
Dan, two more questions. Given that you think stocks are going to be heading higher, what sectors, you said we might be going through a little corrective phase here, but get your money and get ready your shopping list. What would you be shopping for? What kind of sectors look good to you?
Yeah, so, you know, two sort of stand out now and, you know, possibly, you know, for kind of two separate reasons. But one, and then you and I have talked in the past, I have always been sort of a quiet, you know, underneath the surface supporter of banks. And one thing that's key here is bank stocks have, you know, a very strong correlation to the long end of the curve. Not only the long end of the curve on a nominal basis, but the yield curve as it steepens or flattens. So we watch the 210 spread very closely here. When you look at bank stock relative performance, you plot it against the long end of the curve or that spread, you see that the two walk nearly in lockstep to very high correlation. So if I think rates are basing and they're going to start to move higher, and again, the charts on the 10-year note, you know, they do look bullish to me above 160 right now. if you agree that you think we could see a higher rate environment. And again, we're not calling for, you know, the stagflationary 1970s here with rates at, you know, 12%. We're simply talking about mean reversion from a 40-year low in rates at around 1.5%. I mean, I think you could sustain growth anywhere from, you know, upwards of 5-6% on the 10-year note yield. If you think that that is possible, then you do want to start to buy the banks. They're still very cheap on a valuation basis, although they historically trade pretty cheap anyway relative to other sectors. But nonetheless, the other thing we find about the bank stocks in particular, they're still very much under-owned by the institutional community, and they have huge, huge bases behind them. So they're cheap, they're under-owned, there's room for, you know, upward progress there. And again, they have a very high correlation to our interest rate environment. And the other group is, you know, more pro-cyclical, pro-growthy in nature, and that's going to be tech and sort of semiconductors and broad technology. And in fact, we published a piece today just looking at the breakout in technology relative to the broader markets. And what we're seeing is that the technology space is breaking out of a huge, it's almost a 20-year base against the S&P 500. What this tells me is that regardless of, you know, small-term swings in the broader stock markets, these ups and downs and these corrections and these rallies, on a relative basis, broad technology stands in very good shape, in my opinion. In other words, on an intermediate to longer term basis, we would expect that this is going to be one of the leadership groups going forward. So those would be the two groups that I'm sort of looking at opportunistically. And I would say that, you know, I may be still a bit early on the bank call because the long end of the curve can remain stubborn for a while. Our analog where we are in history comes in the early 1940s period, coming out of the Great Depression. There was, you know, concerted effort to keep rates lower for longer through some monetary, you know, stimulus programs at the time. And effectively what it did was it kept that 10-year note, well, we didn't have a 10-year note back then, but we had long bond yields proxies back at that time. They stayed low for and based for maybe 7, 8, 9 years. So you have almost a decade of this sort of lower for longer as, you know, a historical pattern for these markets. That tells me that, you know, the banks, if you want to start buying them, you probably need to be a bit patient here. You're going to have plenty of opportunity. But again, this is more of an investment theme. I'm not looking so much at that as, hey, you know, what are you going to buy for a nice 6-month trade or something? This is going to be slow accumulation. Banks, by the way, they pay pretty decent dividends. And I would say this too, that many of the tech stocks pay decent dividends. You look at something like Intel. Intel is cheap and it pays, I think, 3% versus the 10-year note at 170. So you could see the difference. And again, like I said, our general thesis is that money likes to go where it's treated best. It's in constant rotation. None of these asset classes ever operate in a vacuum. They're in constant competition with each other. And I think as confidence, you know, grows towards the private sector, and really confidence is lost from the public sector, which is our federal government and its massive deficits, and massive, massive bond markets, which are really now a crowded room, I think you're going to continue to see equities outperform, you know, treasury bonds. So again, that's another part of our call. And I think banks can capitalize that on a longer term basis.
And Dan, final question, as we began our discussion talking about seasonalities, and you think we could be in a corrective phase here, maybe into October, what role does a presidential election play in the cycle? Have you done any work on that in terms of what the outcome?
That's a great question. I basically started to do work on that because what I'm hearing as I talk with clients and just what I'm seeing, you know, in reading the press, there's a certain level of volatility and uncertainty that's going to be ascribed to this coming election season. And I almost want to call bunk on that because we've looked at this just from a very top-down approach in the past. And the election season, at least historically in the U.S., has caused little in the way of significant volatility. I'm not saying it's not going to cause any disruption, but if you're talking about major secular market tops in the market, we haven't come across it yet. It's still a work in progress. You know, I don't want to speak to any results I have, but like early findings suggest that, you know, again, investors are very pessimistic coming into the season. If there's more reasons for them to stay away and, you know, continue the buyer strike, then I think they're going to utilize that. But that, to me, again, is just, you know, an opportunity, again, suggesting that equity markets at this point, relative to what they've been in past cycles, are certainly not the crowded trade out there right now. In fact, relatively speaking, they're the empty room. So, you know, I'll allow for anything to happen this coming election season. But based on, you know, historical studies thus far, it shouldn't be earth shattering in terms of ending what I think is a structural bull market cycle here in the U.S.
All right, Dan. Well, listen, as we close, if our listeners like to follow the work that you do, tell them how they could do so.
Yeah, absolutely. So I work at a firm called New Albion Partners. We're a macro research shop based in New York City and San Francisco. You can reach me at, the email would probably be best, T.Wontrowski@newalbionpartners.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Andrew Zatlin, head of Moneyball Economics and one of America's leading economic forecasters, joins us today. And Andrew, when we spoke to you last time, I believe it was in May, you explained how your VIX index was pulling back. And just for a bit of background, your VIX index tracks a lot of different things, mostly very economically sensitive cash spending areas, vices, of course, and it ebbs and flows depending on how much money many of us have. And you saw a pullback coming on that was predicting a wider pullback by the consumer. And I think you said that you were forecasting that to take place in the second half as early as September. So that brings us up to today. We're speaking on September 12th and it is Monday. Tell us what has taken place with the consumer based on what your VIX index is telling you. And do you think that that pullback is still going to be taking place here as we look forward in the months ahead?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's been no change to the VIX index. Just to take a step back, we're talking about luxury spending. We talk about vices. And luxury spending is the thin tip of the spear, as it were, for discretionary spending. And, you know, discretionary spending tends to be blocked off by wages. If I get so much money, I parcel out for my needs, and then I've got whatever's left over for my want. And what we've been seeing is compensation growth has been pretty solid. I'd say about 4% year over year. And so that's been coming in, that's been coming in, that's been coming in. And so people have been spending it, cash in, cash out. And retail spending has been primarily moving at about the same clip. Well, that's been going on for, gosh, the better part of a decade. Can you believe that? It's almost a decade that we've been having this great economic cycle. But all good things have to come to an end. My VIX index tracks all these things that tens of millions of people are doing on a weekly basis. And what we noticed was, and it's leading, this luxury spending, going out and having yet another steak dinner type of experience, going out and gambling. You know, that's what you do when you've got a lot of mad money in your pockets. We're not talking about your ordinary money. Let's take the kids to a movie. We're talking about the mad money. And what I noticed was a sharp pullback that indicated, because it's a leading factor, that retail spending would come down around September. It tends to lead about 4 months. Very important timing. In other words, if you start the clock pullback actually started in May. That luxury spending, boom. Consumers hit the brakes. Not negative, still spending, but just saying, you know what? I'm kind of going to ease off a little bit. That happened in the luxury side in May, and that correlates to an overall spending pullback in September. Here's what's interesting. Go back to what I just said about spending in general is bracketed by how much money's coming in the door. What's interesting is in the first quarter of the year, wages sharply dropped. So all of a sudden, we have one data point that's important. The amount of money coming in suddenly came down, and it has not changed. So naturally, people started to pull back. Well, that's just a function of the equation. Less money coming in, less money going out. But I think there's more going on. I think as we come into the second half, it goes beyond this quantity factor, this, hey, I've got X dollars I can spend and I will spend. Now we've got qualitative factors, and I think those are going to drive us in the second half, and they already are starting to drive us.
Well, oil prices have been stuck in a narrow range, but this is that time of the year. The weather's nice outside, the summer driving season is over, and we get a reprieve in the use of energy. But we're heading into a fall, and weather forecasters are predicting a colder than normal winter. What will that mean for energy prices? Joining us on the program is Greg Weldon. Greg, let's begin with energy, because we've been sort of in this narrow trading range between 40 and 50. And of course, we're in the shoulder months of the year. But, you know, if we take a look at energy production year over year, it's actually down.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on in the energy market, and it kind of belies the fact that the prices haven't moved a heck of a lot right here. I think there's three things I might address. First would be, you know, an ongoing supply side dynamic that doesn't really potentially support any kind of huge move above $50. You know, and overall, U.S. production is down. That's true, but it actually, the decline has kind of ceased. We've gone sideways since the July 4th week. So I think that decline has been something that has been a supportive feature. But at the end of the day, supplies, you know, over 500 million barrels in the U.S. remain onerous. The year-over-year surplus remains what in the past would have been a record high. So you still have kind of this supply-side issue. OPEC's producing more oil than ever before. And as we know, the IEA just revised down their growth estimates for demand. So within that context, you do have some issues. I would say the same thing about gasoline, where you are at a very high level for this time of year in terms of total U.S. motor gasoline supplies. And not only that, typically you are in a declining period and you hit a low some point between usually October and November, typically around the middle of November. And based on the average decline between here and the middle of November over the last 5 years, you're going to end up 25% above the record high for November in terms of supply. Not only will it be a record level of inventories of gasoline for the month of November and a seasonal turn where you start to rise, but, you know, it'll be the highest ever. So I think those are some things that are problematic. On the positive side, you have the potential for the dollar to respond to a disappointment around thoughts that the Fed is going to be hawkish going forward here and will be hiking rates sometime soon. I think that some of the macroeconomic evidence, if they're data dependent, Jim, I don't see how they're moving. Could they move? Of course they can move. They can do whatever they want to do. And that ties us back to my third point, which really makes this, you know, a kind of a 3D puzzle, which is why it's exciting to get up every morning and dig into what's going on. But even if oil were to stay here, which seems potentially, you know, maybe a higher probability that it moves higher and a higher probability that it moves much lower, you will be at a situation where come December, January, and February, you will be significantly higher than you were a year ago. Gasoline bottomed below a dollar at the wholesale level in the futures market last January, February. So, you know, if you were to stay here at $1.40, come February, you're looking at a 40% year-over-year increase in gasoline prices, which will filter into the inflation data. So if you get a situation where gasoline stays here and inflation, you know, they're talking about 2% inflation, and you get this change between the fact that, you know, core inflation is higher than headline inflation. Headline inflation catches up to core inflation because of a mathematical impact just from energy with nothing happening, really. That could be problematic for the Fed. Kind of, it's a conundrum. They're going to raise rates when gasoline, you know, is higher and how that might affect the consumer, let alone the fact that if they don't raise rates here, the dollar likely would decline. That might boost the energy complex. And then you have an even more sticky situation come the end of the fourth quarter, beginning of first quarter next year, as it relates to your inflation readings and how they're impacted by energy. So, you know, my outlook is you're probably going to get more of the same in what we've had in terms of price dynamics, but there is a lot more going on, you know, along the periphery as it relates to what happens here with energy prices.
Yeah, I want to focus on two things when it comes to energy, Greg. It's production is down a little over 2% or almost close to 3% year over year. And the market and traders have been focusing on, you know, the IEA has been lowering their demand estimates. But what they're not focusing on is the fact that year over year, we're consuming more oil globally. So when they're downgrading, they're just downgrading their growth estimates. That's number one. Number two, if you look at Western oil companies, I think the figure is close to some 400,000 jobs have been lost in the energy sector. Projects have been delayed. Projects have been canceled. New leases aren't being bought. And there's another factor that's going on here, which is depletion. And that continues. Every barrel that they produce means there's one less barrel in the ground and you got to replace it. You know, longer term, if we're looking out a couple of years, eventually this is going to catch up. You can't lay off 400,000 workers and cut back all these projects and expect energy production is going to be up there to meet demand.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, my broader, you know, bigger picture macro thesis here is more favorable towards energy than not. And then again, I think, you know, what you just mentioned, there's an even more immediate impact in terms of those lost jobs and in terms of the decline in production, particularly in the places where it had ramped up the most. In the most recent Beige Book that was just released last week, there was very specific mention of hotel vacancies being way down, you know, in other words, the occupation rates being way down in places like the Dakotas, where you had, you know, big energy infrastructure built out. You brought in a whole bunch of employees. They're talking about, you know, shipping and truckers. And I mean, you know, so it is a pretty broad based impact that is in some ways just starting to be felt in the real underlying economies. And that leads me back to the Fed. So in that vein, you know, you just look at the employment numbers. You know, one of the things that kind of mystifies me is this Fed thought process that you're going to see a decline in your average payroll growth month by month because the labor market is tightening. I don't see that. I mean, I still see the peripheral signs in the labor market suggesting there is a lot of slack capacity. Do you have some anecdotal evidence of wage push? You do, but I don't think that's nearly strong enough to support, you know, higher prices that might come about. So this puts the Fed back into play, puts them back in this conundrum. Do we not hike rates here and allow the dollar to go down, which lifts energy prices, which creates inflation that we might have to address more dramatically? That is really not inflation of a healthy means. That's supported by wage inflation. So, you know, the energy sector has a big impact in those ways, too. In terms of thoughts around depletion, I don't worry so much about that. I mean, the offset to that to me would be, yes, that's, you know, you talk about peak oil and you talk about your real macro long-term things. But in terms of the technology, you get prices high enough, you'll see production come out of the woodwork, and the degree to which they can restart some of these shutdown projects more quickly than they may have in the past also plays a role. So, you know, from that perspective, I think that depletion is less of an issue than it is more of a near-term dynamic as it relates to the shutdowns you've already seen and how that is beginning to show up in a more pronounced way, you know, in the kind of the underlying macro economy and how that makes the Fed's job here so much more difficult. You could make a case, and I'm not saying this by any stretch of imagination, but you could make a case that they might want to hike here to lift the dollar a little bit since there's room before it would be making new highs and becoming problematic for emerging markets and commodities and so on and so forth to keep energy from rising, because you know in the next 4 months, you're facing this massive shift in the mathematics behind inflation as it relates to energy. Now, I think that's a little too tricky for the Fed to try and get involved in. But man, you have a lot of food for thought here on the table, that's for sure.
You know, I want to go back to the Fed for a moment, because the markets got slammed a little bit last Friday when you had a Fed governor, I think he was the Fed governor out of Boston, said that they need to raise rates because the economy was in danger of overheating. I think they were worried more about froth in the markets. But Greg, I'm looking at the economic data. You look at it very closely. I mean, do you see with the economy growing at what, 0.8% in Q1, 1.2% in the second quarter, and this certainly with the ISM numbers coming, you know, the ISM manufacturing below 50, the big drop in the ISM non-manufacturing, what the heck are they looking at that they think the economy is in danger of overheating?
Well, let me preface my answer by saying, you know, I don't like to diss the Fed. I mean, you can criticize the Fed all you want, and we kind of do. But man, what a tough job. I wouldn't want that job, you know, for all the money in the Treasury vaults. I mean, theoretically, it is extremely difficult, number one. Number two, you know, I think that there's a lot of puppeteering going on here by the Fed in verbalizing, you know, this hawkish thought and then verbalizing this dovish thought. And you got hawks, you got doves, and to some degree trying to keep the market going sideways. And we've seen that in stocks where you had just one of the most non-volatile periods in history, especially for a market that's at record highs. I mean, it's ridiculous where you're looking at the S&P, you know, closed in a 1.5% range for something like 40 days. I mean, it's really kind of nuts. Within that perspective, I find it interesting. And again, this is why I love doing what I do every day. I mean, Rosengren's comments were not as hawkish as people wanted to make it out to be. If you actually read his speech, which of course I do read every one of the speeches that I can word for word, did he talk about an overheating economy? Yeah, he did. He wasn't saying we need to raise rates now because the economy might overheat. He's saying, you know, potentially if we don't, you will get risk-taking that could, in fact, boost the markets and boost the economy and tighten the labor market to a degree we might have to tighten more down the road. He saw that as a risk, but not as big a risk as the downside risk. So from that perspective, we kind of trashed his comments as not being as hawkish as the market took them to be, number one. Number two, I think a much bigger role, a much bigger catalyst last week for the decline was the fact that the ECB basically, you know, kind of gave the finger to the market in the sense that people are looking for them to continue to push, and they didn't. And in fact, they said, we don't see the need for more QE here. There's a lot of talk about how negative rates are negatively impacting banks, particularly true in Japan, which we haven't even talked about yet, and that's a big thing coming up the next BOJ meeting. But I think it really goes back to a macro secular thought that you and I have discussed for years on this program, and that is that the main thing that is causing asset price reflation has been central banks. And the second you say to yourself, well, hey, maybe the ECB is not going to do anymore, and maybe the Fed is going to raise rates, and you get any kind of even a hint of hawkishness in comments like Rosengren's, the market gets scared because they know there's little propping this up in terms of, well, you just said, the real economy. We wrote on the U.S. 3 days in a row back, whatever it was, 2 weeks ago, a week ago, when you had ISM, non-manufacturing ISM, you had four data points in a row, including the Beige Book, which were all, you know, kind of decidedly negative in terms of final demand. So from that perspective, again, if they are data dependent, there's no way they're moving here. But I think to suggest that they're data dependent is to not give them enough potential latitude to do something for more psychological reasons. So I don't know how it plays out. It'll be interesting to see. I think that my basic view is, and I've been doing this, you know, me and you are old school. I mean, doing this 31 years now. At the end of the day, the markets are kind of trying to dictate to the Fed, do not raise rates. The economy is not healthy enough. So the stock market sells off, and it's kind of like almost a kind of sending a shot across the bow of the Fed, where the market and the participants and, you know, and the macroeconomy essentially saying, please don't hike rates.
Yeah, I mean, because you take a look at all the economic numbers we're looking at, ISM, a lot of these things, and I agree with you on the labor market, is there's a lot more slack than they think there, and especially if you look at the U6 figures, and some believe the U6 figures is still understating the market. So let's talk about central banks and what they're doing. We've got Japanese bond yields are rising again. You've got some kind of hint at something new maybe coming out of Japan. Greg, when they did negative interest rates back in February, instead of stimulating the economy, the average Japanese went out. There was a run on safes. They started buying gold. They did the opposite of what the government thought they would do.
I think there's a bigger picture shift that's kind of taking place here behind the scenes, something I've been talking about for several weeks, if not maybe a couple of months now. And Japan will be a litmus test for this. And I think Kuroda had a very interesting speech on September 5th last week, and we just wrote about it 2 days ago, where central banks are realizing there is a limit to negative interest rates. And it is the way it impacts banks and how this, in fact, could shake confidence to the degree that it negatively impacts the macroeconomy and is not a positive. And from that perspective, the thought process, and you get this, man, the ECB was all over this. Draghi was all over this last week. Japan has talked about it, and you have certainly the situation with the elections in the U.S. It is kind of like, guess what? Monetary policy has done about as much as it can right here in the context of what it's supposed to be doing. It's now on fiscal policy. And to what degree can QE support fiscal policy without pushing rates deeper into negative territory? And I think that's what's going on in Japan. And we wrote about this. It was 2 days ago. Kuroda's speech was really interesting, talking about how we have to assess the negative impacts of negative rates. And that while there is no limit to how low we can push rates, because of course he wants to keep all the options open and he wants to keep dangling that carrot in front of the market, the tone of his speech was much more of, you know, there is a limit to how deep negative rates can go here, and that maybe something new has to be done. And that's something new. And I can tell you from talking to some of the people that I get lucky enough to be able to talk to that are kind of in the academic world, if you will, that are advisors to governments and central banks, it is really shifting towards what do we need to do fiscally. And like I said, Draghi brought this point up several times, not only in his statement on Thursday, but in the Q&A afterwards, that, you know, other policymakers and other measures need to step up to the plate and be utilized here because, you know, again, our effectiveness is starting to run thin. And from that perspective, I mean, really, It's great to have the U.S. stock market at a record high, but the rate of return over the last 2 years has virtually been nil. And that dates back to when? August of 2014. And why is that significant? Because that's the day that the Fed stopped buying Treasury bonds.
So as we take a look at this, we've seen QE. We've now seen negative interest rates. What about the possibilities of helicopter drops? The IMF has been urging countries to do things more on the fiscal side, recognizing that monetary policy has a limit. Greg, what's the possibility that we end up seeing some kind of helicopter drop, some kind of fiscal stimulus coming from governments that's simply mopped up by, printing of money?
Yeah, I think that that's a very real possibility, number one. I think that I can make a very good analogy, and we've been making this analogy now kind of since Bernanke visited Tokyo, whatever that was, you know, a few weeks, 6-8 weeks ago, really discussing this around thinking that they can't do helicopter money. And some people want to shrug that off just immediately as being, almost like a farce or, you know, some kind of folly to even think that that's possible. To think that helicopter money and the printing of money that for me would, you know, one of two things. In Japan, they're talking about printing out vouchers and just handing them out to consumers to go buy stuff, circumventing, like you mentioned earlier, where when you have negative rates and you basically have to pay not only governments, but corporate bonds or some are at negative rates, you're going to go out and pay a company to hold your money as a safeguard, or you're going to buy gold. You're going to buy gold every day of the week. I just don't even know how that's supposed to work going forward. But it's either some kind of consumer voucher program or whether it's actually QE-supported money printing that goes right to the government for fiscal infrastructure spending. Okay. If you call that helicopter money, I think you can call that helicopter money. I think it's a very real possibility. And to suggest that it is not is to go back to 2006 when I wrote my book, Gold Trading Bootcamp, when we were very much talking about how you were going to have a credit crisis based on housing in the U.S. that was going to cause the Fed to have to buy trillions of dollars of treasury bonds and expand their balance sheet. And guess what? That was as much heresy in a thought process as it is, you know, then, as it is today, to suggest that, you know, helicopter money is suggesting some kind of heresy in terms of monetary policy. I think the odds, I mean, I remember going on Squawk Box on CNBC and discussing the Fed expanding their balance sheet, you know, monetizing treasury debt. And I got looked at by the host of the show as if I had no head. How could you even suggest that? That's crazy. And the end game is, then what do you do? Well, the answer to that was you bought gold. That was our answer then. That's our answer now. Because I think in terms of the litmus test coming up with Japan, I think it's a very real possibility that that is the next wave. It's linked to fiscal policy. It's supported by QE. You've seen papers written by the Fed that suggest, based on PSTAR, their new favorite phrase, that this is the way to go. And I think it is the way they will go because, and you know as well as I do, at the end of the day, if you're staring into a deflationary scenario, you will err on the side of easing every single time. You will do whatever you will have to do to avoid the pain of a debt deflation, and they will. And ultimately, that's probably the way it goes, i.e. helicopter money. And the answer to that is, that's why gold is still a value right here.
All right. Well, listen, Greg, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you do, tell them how they could do so, please.
Sure. We'd be happy to have anyone listening come and sign up for a free trial to our daily research product. It's called Weldon Live. It's one product. It's one price. It comes in three parts. It's a daily 12 to 15 minute video that draws off our daily chart pack, which is usually about 70 pages long a day. And it's a little too much, but it's a pretty, you know, free flowing chart package where we cover seven sectors a day: global macro, global fixed income, foreign exchange, global stock indexes and ETFs, industrial and precious metals, energy, and agricultural commodities. Those seven sectors covered every day and then encapsulated in a 12-minute video where I actually, it's kind of like a conference presentation. You don't see me, it's the charts and me talking about the charts and using a pointer to kind of make the connections between foreign exchange and fixed income and global macro. And then the third part of the product is Trade Lab, which is specific trading recommendations, you know, on a discretionary basis, and also a lot of good sector work in terms of what sectors are outperforming or underperforming and need to be overweight or underweight. And all of that can be found and accessed via a free trial at WeldonOnline.com. That's WELDON, Weldon Online, one word, .com.
You know, we keep hearing about the imminent collapse of the dollar from some quarters out there. They've been saying imminent collapse for quite a few years right now. But I often wonder whenever I hear that, what does that mean? Does it mean we're going back to the Stone Ages and bartering or what? Well, okay, let's frame that. Lionel Shriver is going to be Jim's guest on The Big Picture coming up next. What happens if the dollar collapses in 2029? Not too far in the near future. What then? Well, we'll find out as the big picture presents this scenario as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.